reach, and Dorian thinks he can make out Daniel in the distance, hanging onto a deck plate. Fury shakes his limbs. They had a plan. This should have worked. It always works out for him, and now his ship is missing. He imagines Ken, Susan, and Montrell taking off, writing him off in the company logs as a loss, making a footnote out of him with their treachery. He imagines them arriving back on Earth. "We tried everything we could," they'll say, "but Director Suddler was killed in the accident." They'll make him a goddamned line item.
"Dorian!"
Anne calls. She's made it to one side of the hallway, mooring herself with her muscular arms.
"We have to help the others."
He's far enough away from the breach that the suction isn't so bad. Worse than an earth storm, better than a jet engine intake. He can still find the means to clamber to his feet and rush over.
"Seal the bulkhead,"
he shouts back over the din.
"Don't worry about the safety protocols, just seal it."
"What?"
It's not the reaction he was expecting.
"They're not going to make it. There are a dozen hungry aliens out there and a shredding outer hull."
"Fuck you."
Anne says it with such force that she spits in his face. She maneuvers across the hallway to a firebox, breaking it open. The shards of glass blow down the corridor toward the survivors, sharp pieces glinting as they swirl out of the breach. She pulls out the heavy hose nozzle and throws it into the wind, where it catches a gust. The line whips from the case at breakneck speed before snapping taut. The nozzle wriggles and twists halfway to the embattled crew, tantalizingly out of reach. Undeterred, she begins rappelling down the line.
"Anne! Don't be stupid!"
She's just going to be a fish on a hook down there when the creatures spot her. He doesn't see any of the malevolent shadows, but he knows they're out there, ready to strike the second they receive an opportunity. She doesn't look back at him, focusing instead on getting to those stranded near the breach.
"God damn it, Anne!"
He could seal her out right now. If he pressed the emergency closure on the door, it wouldn't reopen until pressure equalized. The heavy steel would chop that fire hose instantly. Anne and the others would suffocate. And though there were bound to be more aliens on board the Cold Forge, at least Dorian wouldn't be stuck in violent decompression. Then again, the Athenian is gone, and Dorian doesn't have the crew codes that will grant him access to the escape pods. They may have given them to him in a briefing at some point, but no one ever keeps their safety packets when they come aboard a station. The crew will know the codes because they've drilled once a month. Anne will have the codes. If he doesn't help her, he will die. Working his way over to the hose control panel, he twists the valve, filling the hose with 83 bars of fire-retardant chemicals.
"What the fuck are you doing?"
she screams as the hose inflates under her grip, but he doesn't reply. His keen eyes scan the rafters, and he spots one of the snatchers creeping toward her, ready to drop down in spite of the howling gale.
"Above you!"
He thrusts his finger toward it in an exaggerated gesture, willing her to see the threat. The beast unfolds like lethal origami, all hard angles, save for the curve of its domed skull. Anne's attention flicks upward, and she twists the hose to fire a high-powered flush of white chemicals at the creature. It screeches in hatred as they strike, sending it off course, flailing into a pair of Rose Eagle developers. The thing wastes no time in assaulting its new targets. It flings one toward the breach, correctly intuiting that person will die a more horrible death in the vacuum of space. This surprises Dorian. Prior to this moment, he's always expected their violence to be a food-seeking behavior. It could have easily brained one and impaled the other, keeping them for a snack down the road. Maybe it's more majestic than that. Perhaps they simply love to kill. Maybe for them it's their most sincere form of expression. This one locks its jaws around the shoulder of the developer, and Dorian steels himself for a killing blow. Instead, the beast turns toward him and charges up the steel grates, finding purchase in the finger-shaped holes. Maybe it hasn't seen him yet. Without eyes, who can know what they perceive? Dorian squeezes against one of the support columns, doing everything in his power to hide his presence. Like a fish disappearing beneath the surface of the water with a bug, it bounds into the bowels of the open skiff, hauling the screaming programmer in tow. Whatever it has planned for the woman, it's probably worse than death. Dorian squints, and at the far end of the docking area, he can just make out two dark-skinned people, one thin and frail, the other in full head bandages, hanging on for dear life. They're closer to the breach than he is, and must be feeling an incredible strain. A large electric wheelchair slides toward the tear to be sucked out, and he realizes that's Blue Marsalis and Kambili Okoro. He can't stand the thought of having her die like this. She's treated him like shit so many times, only to be sucked out of a hole. It's pathetic. It's boring. It fills Dorian's blood with fire just thinking about it. He should be the one to beat her. He has to be the one. Dorian! Anne's words distract him. She's accrued a few survivors, all latched onto the hose in a cluster. He spots Javier and Lucy among their number, but the rest appear to be low-level techs, custodians, and developers. Daniel Cardozo isn't with them. Pulling them up won't work. Their combined weight is too much. The temperature has plummeted, and his head grows light. The safety protocols will seal this section soon. Dorian wraps his arms around the hose and pulls, but it's like tugging on a boulder. "Hit the auto reel, you fucking idiot!" Anne screams at him. If she didn't have the escape pod codes, he'd definitely drop the door on her. Instead, he hefts his way to the hose controls, purges the line to slacken it, and hits the auto reel. The winching system inside whines at the weight, but impossibly, it begins to pull them closer. The air is unbearably thin, and warning lights erupt from hidden panels, announcing that the partition is going to drop. He looks from the crew to the door, mentally judging the distance. It's going to drop on them either way. He may as well go ahead and shut it. Using the gratings as a purchase, he climbs across the door controls, keenly watching the progress of the crew as he does. He'll give them 10 more seconds, but they're all screwed. The door begins sliding shut. As they draw close to the entrance, Dorian peers around them to watch Daniel struggling. The creatures have begun to circle him, looking for the best way to attack without being sucked outside. With each passing second, the atmosphere dwindles and the suction lessens. He'll be a meal soon enough. The airlock next to Dorian beeps, its sound startling him, almost costing him his grip. Marcus comes storming out, tearing off his helmet. Dorian can't recall ever seeing a synthetic move that fast, and his stomach flips at the sight. At first, he believes it's Blue, come to exact some kind of revenge on him. Except he locked Blue out, so that can't be the case. Marcus vaults through the mercurial wind currents, making adjustments to his balance using a series of quick gestures and twists, snatching the grating by Anne's team to make an impressive landing. He then grasps the hose with one hand and drags it forward, using his other to pull himself along the deck. The air has grown so thin that sounds are dimmed. The lab tech at the back of the hose train faints, and his unconscious body tumbles toward the breach. One of the creatures snatches him out of midair, sinking its teeth deep into the fatty tissue around his thigh. Dorian searches again for Blue and Kambili, and sees another of the bugs clamoring after her. It makes an aborted attempt at a pounce, fails, and sets up to try again. He watches as Kumbili grabs her and pulls her toward the door, showing little regard for his own safety. Chivalry is an artifact of his earthbound life. It's useless out here. Earth teaches people that everyone should be treated equally. They're all worth the same. It's a bunch of garbage. Anyone who can't pull his own weight deserves to be dragged down by it, no matter what the reason. To see Kumbili risking his own life to save Blue Marsalis just because she's pathetic strikes Dorian as a farce. Kumbili shoves Blue under the partition, just in time to have his arms sheared off at the elbows. The snatcher is right behind him, about to pounce. Yet Kumbili should have been the one who survived, with four limbs and a long life expectancy. He should have cut Blue, with her stink of sickness, out of the herd. That's the truth that animals know, and it's the way of the free market. Kumbili has suffered the wages of altruism. Blue is nowhere to be seen. The door seals with a thunk, and the sound of the gale disappears, leaving only the alarms. Those who can rush to the flashing oxygen panel. They unspool masks for themselves while Marcus assists those who can't make it on their own. Dorian is among the first to get sips of oxygen while the bulkhead repressurizes. There are 12 people and 8 masks, and the survivors take turns. Marcus apportions the oxygen treatments, taking the mask from Dorian's hand and giving it to Javier. He then guides them one by one to the airlock before joining everyone inside. Dorian considers telling Marcus about Blue, then decides against it. Better to keep him focused on their survival. If Blue isn't dead already, she will be. Soon enough. We have to remain here for the next 5 hours, Marcus says. He opens a control panel and adjusts the parameters. Dorian's ears pop loudly as the air pressure returns. It feels different somehow, heavier.
What? No, Lucy says. Those things are right outside, Blue.
It's Marcus, the synthetic replies. Explains all the flipping and shit when you came to the rescue, Javier mutters. Just glad you were there, man. Blue's whereabouts are currently unknown, Marcus says. Then he sweeps the group with his gaze. You are all likely to be suffering from decompression sickness, and you need hyperbaric treatment to prevent an arterial gas embolism.
Fuck. The bends, Anne says.
5 hours? Dorian says. Marcus nods and gestures to the seats. There are a few spacesuits hanging on the wall, and some of the survivors pull them down, placing them open on the floor for use as bedding. The airlock is cramped for a dozen people, but they manage to find enough space for everyone to relax. Marcus stands in the corner, keeping silent vigil over the tableau. Dorian chooses a spot closest to the outer hatch, resting his back against it. Every muscle in his body is slackened by exhaustion, and his mind doesn't want to work right as the adrenaline drains from his body. People are crying. Lucy makes an idiotic whimpering noise that sounds like a cross between creaky metal and a sinus infection. He wants to tell her to shut up, but decides another approach will be more to his advantage.
They're all dead,
she says, repeating the phrase as if it wasn't completely obvious. Dorian takes her hand, those frail, slender bones, and squeezes, gently. He looks into her eyes. But we're not, he says. So kindly shut the fuck up. Mercifully, she does, until they hear a loud thump on the outside of the airlock. Everyone shrieks except Dorian and Marcus. They calmly peer outside through the porthole. Dorian expects to see a piece of debris, or maybe one of the escape pods, but comes face to face with a black skull and knife-sharp teeth, visible through the thick glass. It pulls back and butts the airlock again, to no avail. More screams. "Don't worry," Marcus says. "That's 12 inches of unbreakable carbon crystal with a very small diameter. It could withstand a direct hit from a starship."
"Easy for you to say,"
Lucy cries, and her distress eases Dorian's heart. It's hard to put a finger on why he hates her so much. Maybe it's her constant overreactions, which seem almost fake. He places a hand against the porthole and watches as the beast strikes the glass again and again, to the great distress of the airlock occupants. This close, in the shadow of the station, he can sense the raw strength of the thing, its drool freezing to its face. It's probably dying, but it shows no signs of slowing down. What majesty. Driven to waste. "It would appear that the freezing point of its blood is far lower than that of a human," Marcus says. "That's not surprising," Dorian replies. "It's the perfect killing machine." "Thanks for saving us," Javier says to Anne, then nods at Dorian. "We were fucked out there." His words seem to calm the others, at least somewhat. "You should all get some rest," Marcus says. "We'll need to move as soon as the time is up." The others look to him as though he's gone mad, but Dorian knows he's right. Dorian feels no remorse, no pity for those lost to the violence. They're dead, and he isn't. They are useless, and he is paramount. He can't allow sentimentality to deprive him of critical rest. So Dorian drifts off, lulled by the bass drum of the perfect skull. Maybe it's been an hour. Maybe it's been three. But Blue's muscles feel as though they're going to fall off her bones. She's given up on trying to drag herself without her belly touching the ground, and long ago scraped off her colostomy bag. Not that she knows when she's going to eat again. No G-tube, no shit filling her intestines. Her stomas itch. Every yard is agony. Her tender elbows are bruised and swollen, and much of her has been scraped raw by the deck plating. With each push, she swears that it's her last. And yet she always rises, always pulls herself another step closer. Until her knee catches fire. It's a tickle, for just a moment, in the back of her joint. Then a full-blown burning, the likes of which she's never felt. It's like a Charlie horse fucking a stab wound. Aliens be damned, she screams out at the top of her lungs. Her cries echo down the halls, and for the second time that day, she summons a strength she'd thought long lost. It won't subside. Blue's eyes drift between the crew quarters and the med bay, and she knows what she must do. There's no time to pause. And yet she can barely think due to the utter anguish spreading through her legs. She drags herself to the medbay door, closer than she had guessed, thank God, as the fire spreads to her other knee. She repeats every curse word she knows as if it's a solemn prayer and pulls herself toward the nearest operating bed. Pulling herself up the side, one handhold at a time, she rolls onto the mattress. It might be the softest thing she's ever felt in her life, though she can't enjoy it with her knees about to explode. Blue keeps racking her brain for some explanation, but nothing comes to her, and she can't concentrate. She grabs the control panel wires, pulls the console close enough to see with her failing eyes, and hopes to God the bed isn't on Titus's network. "Scanning," the bed says in a gentle voice coming through its tinny speakers. Blue lets out a breath in the closest thing she can get to relief. "Please wait." Scanners circle the bed on long arms. Then she cries out as the pain strikes her again, and she bends her knees, clutching them close. The scanners pull away and go still. Miraculously, the agony reduces slightly, and she can think again. Reinitializing scans, the bed says. Are you able to keep still?
Yes, Blue whispers, her throat raw.
The scanners circle the bed again, and Blue wishes she was at a real hospital instead of this pathetic simulation. She wants real doctors, with real gear and real databases containing data for almost every disease known to mankind, though that didn't help her when she was diagnosed with Bashara's syndrome.
Were you recently exposed to a vacuum or depressurization?
Yes.
You are now suffering from decompression sickness, sometimes called DCS, diver's disease, or the bends. You have bubbles inside your bloodstream, composed of soluble gases which emerge during a decompression event.
The bed produces a servo for intravenous feeding.
Recommended treatment, hyperbaric oxygenation and rehydration. Can you get to an airlock?
No. She gasps as cold antiseptic sprays across her hand, and the bed slips a needle into her. It shunts aside the first few drops of blood for various test procedures.
Then the best treatment is rehydration and rest. Elevated heart rate detected. Are you under emotional duress?
Blue laughs.
Yes.
Acknowledged. This system will monitor the nitrogen bubbles for potential type 2 complications, and you will be administered a sedative.
Wait, what?
Blue tries to sit up, but her arm is caught in the IV. She can't be unconscious right now. There's too much to do. But the chemicals flow into her arm, sweet and warm, and she knows it's too late. The world swims only briefly, before sleep strikes her like a hammer. 18. Reset. They've been high on heavy oxygen for hours, taking frequent breathing breaks to avoid toxicity. The air is thick, hot, and foul-smelling, and the extreme flammability just makes him want to smoke. In another hour, they'll be close to Earth barometric pressure.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe,
Dorian whispers, his slender finger pointing toward each person trapped in the airlock with him.
Catch a...
You better fucking say tiger, Javier says. Dorian smirks, then continues the rhyme in the requested fashion. Javier shakes his head and turns away, curling up next to Lucy on an old spacesuit. Do you think the traitor is dead? Dorian asks.
What traitor?
Javier asks.
Someone brought Silver Smile across the air gap to Titus. Someone opened the manual-only kennel doors.
Dorian picks at his nails. Maybe that someone is floating outside right now, frosted over. That's not appropriate, Director Subler, Marcus says.
But my money is on Dr. Marsalis, Dorian continues. If I had to guess, that is.
I think so too, Lucy says.
Marcus, what has she been making you do?
Marcus shakes his head. I'm afraid I can't answer that question unless there's a direct threat to your safety. It would be in violation of Dr. Marsalis's privacy. Furthermore, I have no ability to recall actions taken while I've been under her control.
Screw that, Lucy says, sitting up. We're not safe. We're stuck in an airlock, and there are fucking monsters outside. Tell us anything you know.
Director, Anne says, putting a warm hand on his forearm. Do you think now is really the time?
Dorian quirks an eyebrow.
What?
Did you have something better to do? Most of us are dead. Someone is responsible, and I, for one, would like to know who it is. Two of the techs in the corner huddle closer, and one of them yawns. No one besides Dorian has had a wink of sleep. In fact, he's found the airlock to be his most comfortable accommodation to date. There's nothing more bracing than the edge of death, Nothing more satisfactory than another moment of survival. Blue was in league with someone off-station, Dorian says, trying to steal the results of the project and keep them to herself. That's why we had her old boss arrested, so it's not hard to put the pieces together. Just in case Blue isn't dead. He doesn't want any talk of going to rescue her. There are mutterings of assent among the assembly, especially those who knew about Blue's hidden server. It won't take long to herd the sheep toward his way of thinking, and though it gives him great joy to think of turning them against Blue, he also wonders how wise his strategy may be. What if she's not the saboteur? At this moment, the Cold Forge could be exporting ridiculous amounts of data, and no one would know. There could be long-range transmitters blasting out secrets to various and sundry parties, and none of the station's countermeasures would stop them. Everything is offline. Everything is compromised. At some point, this might have been Blue's plan, but he'd interrupted her. There was no point to killing everyone on the station save for revenge, and that's too petty for such a pretentious woman. Besides, Dorian already had interviewed Kambili Okoro to get the location of her research. Blue was trying to synthesize some super cure, not murder everyone. The real saboteur is someone else. "Are there any escape pods left, Marcus?" he asks. "Yes. It appears there is one," Marcus replies. "At least that's what I saw when I rescued you. Though my memory is impeccable, something may have happened to the pod since that time." "We need to get to it," Dorian says. "Need to get out of here." Lucy laughs. "Those pods support two people each. Even if you were willing to remain unfrozen for the 10-year journey back to Earth, you'd run out of food." He does a quick count of the survivors in the airlock. Javier, Lucy, Anne, himself. There are 13, all told, if he counts Marcus. Blue is somewhere out there, too, if she's still alive. But he'll leave her behind when the time comes. He'd fuck over everyone here for a shot at one of the two remaining pod seats. When he imagines the scenarios for escape, he's always alone. A sudden rush fills his gut, like he started a long fall. It takes all his concentration not to vomit in the hot, foul-smelling airlock. Tools rise from the ground. His hands begin to float. They've lost gravity. "Alert," Titus says. "Gravity drive failure." "No shit, Sherlock." A murmur rises in the crowd as they search for anything to which they can cling. "We have to reset Titus," Marcus says, looking directly at Dorian. "If the computer has lost control of gravity, Silver Smile may find a way to vent us into space." "Wouldn't that be something?" Dorian responds. "I suggest we cut short our hyperbaric therapy and address the Titus reset." Marcus peers out of the airlock window into the depths of the station. "Someone will need to accompany me, as I do not have administrative access to Titus." "Why not?" Anne asks. "Shit," Javier says, his voice falling. "Synthetics never do. They're not allowed to control life support. They're not allowed to use firearms. They can't do anything that would endanger real people." Dorian looks Javier over. The station's sysadmin has grown awfully pale for a brown man. His lips are white where they should be pink, and his eyes are pink where they should be white. His hands shake, and he's only weakly holding on to the seat where he had been comfortably resting. "I'm going to have to go out there," Javier says. "I'm the best qualified person to do it." Fucking shit. But Javier could be the saboteur. After all, he's the one who introduced Silver Smile into Juno. It was his mistake that brought the first round of ruin. If he continues to cripple RB-232's systems, he can run any play he wishes unopposed.
He might just grab a spacesuit and head for the escape pod.
I'll go too,
Dorian says. You need someone to watch your back. Javier eyes him, surprise in his expression, and gives him a smile.
Thanks, man.
Marcus, you should act as a distraction, Dorian continues. Javier and I can handle the reset. Very well. I'll go out ahead and see if I can draw some attention away from your egress. Marcus grabs onto the access panel, preparing to open the hatch. Their ears pop as pressure equalizes with the rest of the station. From what I have observed, the animals will be torpid without targets to hunt.
Great, Javier says.
I should go too, Anne says, but Dorian stops her.
No way. There are a lot of hurt people here, and as head of security, you've got the most medical training. You can't just abandon them.
While you two are geared for combat ops?
She crosses her arms.
Come on. An out-of-shape sysadmin and an exec in a cheap suit?
Hey, it used to be a nice suit, Dorian counters with a wink. We're not going into combat. If something happens, we're just going to run. And in zero-G, that'll be pretty easy.
Anne shakes her head but doesn't say anything.
Look, he says, lowering his voice. In management, you have to learn how to make these kinds of tough decisions. Decisions by the numbers. I've got essentially no skills, but your group has backup programmers, techs, and you. You're the only remaining soldier on board. I'm comparatively expendable.
You can't think about things like that.
That's my job.
It's cute how worried she is for him. When he thinks back to the fierce warrior who subdued him and fucked him senseless, he can't help but grin. She's thinking of these people as her family, and it's clouding her judgment. It's hard to know exactly how he'll exploit that, but he feels certain he can manipulate her when the time comes.
Okay, she says. But if you're going out, so are we. We have to get somewhere better than this airlock, somewhere we can call for help.
Our comms are probably fried, Lucy says. Silver Smile will have burned out the alignment motors.
She sucks her lower lip.
I wrote the code to make it do that, so if it's working...
What about Rose Eagle? Dorian asks. It has all of the equipment to create entangled comms.
Some of the techs murmur in agreement. Even if Silver Smile has gutted that project beyond all repair, he has offered them a moment of hope. They'll be even more amenable to following his orders.
There might be some uncorrupted images of the project, Javier says. I mean, it's not likely, but it's possible.
Okay, Dorian says. Marcus will run distractions, Javier and I will reinitialize Titus, and Anne will take her team to Rose Eagle.
Anne claps him on the shoulder and gives him a brief squeeze. It's hard not to retch from her sentimental bullshit.
Don't die, she says.
Dorian nods. Count on me, babe.
Their trek through the corridors is silent. Both Dorian and Javier steady in their purpose. Dorian can do this because he knows the score, that forward is the only direction, that if death comes, he's on the most sensible course. His head is clear, and his eyes are sharp. He doesn't know how Javier has decided to process their journey. They kick off the walls with bare feet, carefully planning their landings at each support pylon. It's tempting to simply make a single leap, aimed straight at Titus's server farm. But they might want to change course if they see some hazard. A snatcher, for example. Unlike the crew quarters and the project decks of the skiff, the central strut is unpolished and industrialized. The sort of place with lots of exposed ducts and conduits. The handholds are easy to find, and controlling their vectors is simple, as long as they don't overcommit.
A sudden hiss erupts to his right, and Dorian slams into the hall, expecting claws to seize his flesh. Instead, he finds one of the atmospheric pumps churning away, trying and failing to keep the ship's gases balanced. Without help from the centralized climate systems, the survivors will eventually run out of oxygen. The good news is that the number of people still breathing is rapidly diminishing. He glances back. Javier stares at him, trembling. Dorian checks to make sure the man isn't looking at something behind him. When there's nothing there, he mouths the words, "Let's go," and takes off again. Even at their slow pace, they reach Titus's server farm within 5 minutes. When they open the doors, Dorian is shocked by the gust of hot air that greets him. Fans roar ineffectually, drowning out any noises inside. Uneven lights flicker overhead, driving shadows across the open spaces and workstations. The place stinks of hot wiring and melted plastic, and the beginnings of an electrical fire. He scans the scene, searching in corners and under tables for a telltale flicker of oily chitin and bone. "Shit, shit, shit," Javier mutters, muscling past. "It shut down the thermal controls." The sysadmin swims through the room, bouncing off server racks and pulling up to one of the consoles. Purpose seems to give him new energy. Dorian goes to follow him, but burns his hand on one of the metal racks. "Don't touch that," Javier says. "It's where most of Titus's heavy lifting is done, so it'll be the hottest." "How did it get this bad?" "The virus didn't have to fight its way through the fringe systems. Someone must have installed it with full rights." Dorian nods, his hands smarting, and wants to slap Javier for failing to warn him. Heat waves radiate through the air around him, making his head swim. "Where is it safe to stand?" "Got some empty rack mounts over there by the monitors," Javier says. "Should be good." Dorian nods. "Anything you need from me?" "Just keep an eye out." Dorian pushes off to the front door and pokes his head out. To his left is the long passageway to the skiff. To his right, the emergency partition to the decompressed docking area and the last remaining escape pod. If he had the code to activate it, he could bump off Javier, don a spacesuit from the airlock, decompress the central strut, and get the fuck out of the cold forge. But he doesn't have the code, and so he must make himself useful. He returns to Javier's side, looking over his progress. A thick binder drifts through the air, a pen hanging from it by a chain. Dorian idly pushes it aside, looking for any good news from his companion. The screen flickers, and the Weyland-Yutani logo animates into life, but the loading progress is slow. It's less responsive than Dorian has ever seen a station computer, and he leans over to speak into Javier's ear. "How bad is it?" Javier ignores the question and types his password, which looks like rash501! But it's wrong. Javier types it again, and Dorian gets a better look. Thrash 3501! The sysadmin accesses Titus's core functions to get a readout. Only 16% of the servers are still operational. Then the readout vanishes. "What happened?" "Silver smile," Javier says. "Because we pulled up the readouts, it targeted them. The only things it can't touch are the core op and the connection logs. This is going to suck." He points to a junction box in the boiling hot part of the room. "Kill the power over there." Dorian complies, pushing off in that direction. Because there's no gravity to pull down the denser gases, pockets of hot and cold air intermingle randomly, passing over his sweaty face to nauseating effect. The metal of the junction box is scalding hot, and the lever locking the door in place obstinately refuses to be pushed.
Dorian wraps his suit jacket around the lever and shoves it until it locks upward. The door opens, revealing a reboot procedure outlined in pictograms and iconography.
If we're lucky, Javier says, we're going to get back thermals, power, access control, and maybe life support. Titus is fighting pretty hard. Orbitals are fucked.
Dorian scans the warnings, then engages the master cutoff switch. The server room goes black, becoming a smoldering steel box. Sweat pours from his face, and for a moment he can see nothing. Then an orange star appears in the darkness, an amber LED diffracted through the Fresnel lens of a switch housing. Dorian reaches up and presses it. The room thrums back to life, and once dim lights overhead click on with full intensity. Squinting, Dorian peers around, half expecting to find the place looking looted. But it's surprisingly clean. External vents blast in frosty air, a balm upon his moist skin. Monitors all across the room come alive with the olive-drab background of Weyland-Yutani's logos, though half of the server racks still blare warning lights across their housings. Those computers are probably burnt to a crisp.
Hang on to something, Javier says. I think I can get gravity back online.
There's a tremendous clatter throughout the bay, as all of the loose objects fall to the ground. Though Dorian believes himself stable, it's like invisible hands tug him from his feet onto the hard steel deck. It's pleasant down there, and Dorian rests his face against the cooling floor plates for a moment, as he acclimates to the returned force. 10 minutes pass, as Javier lashes together the remaining computers into a network capable of caring for the station.
How long does this normally take you? Dorian asks, glancing at the door.
3 fucking weeks, man.
What are you going to do?
Javier shakes his head. It ain't going to be a Rolls Royce, but I can get this baby running in a nominal state.
Enough to keep us alive.
The sysadmin glares at him before returning to his keyboard.
Back off and go watch for trouble, man. You're distracting me.
He points to a monitor on the far wall, which tiles over in a pattern like a chessboard.
Got the security feeds online. Check them.
Dorian's eyes travel to the binder on the ground, with its chained pen. He kicks it closed and picks it up. It's Titus's physical access log, though he doubts the saboteur would have signed in. He pages through it and finds about 80 signatures, the last one from 2 weeks ago. Most likely there have been accesses beyond that point, and the organization around here is a shit show. No wonder the station is compromised. Dorian can't let this opportunity pass him by. When is he going to be in here again? He needs to know the name of the saboteur. It'll be someone who has the codes for that last escape pod, someone who's gunning for it just as much as him. Everyone is a threat on some level, but the saboteur would do anything to leave. He hunkers down next to the monitors and puzzles through the timeline. Silver Smile infected Titus at almost exactly the same time the kennels were opened. According to Dick Mackey, the cell doors were manual operation only. There were no network controls, so someone had to free the beasts by hand. But infecting Titus required the saboteur to be physically outside the skiff, away from Juno control. Those were 2 exclusive actions, taken simultaneously. Blue could be in 2 places at once, but that was a best-case scenario. Her frail body would never be able to get to the last escape pod, not with the docking bay exposed to the vacuum of space. He doubted she could even don a suit. Moreover, Marcus could never open the kennels without her piloting him. A synthetic would do everything it could to prevent harm to humans, and the synths that lacked that programming tended to have spectacular emotional breakdowns. If Marcus had opened the cages, Dorian would have seen some evidence in his behaviors. There had to be 2 saboteurs. Were they working together?
No one had escaped the Cold Forge to Dorian's knowledge. Yet surely the person who destroyed Titus had a plan to flee. Why let the beasts out of their cages? It couldn't have been Javier. He was helping Dorian decode Blue's research when the attack hit. Javier, check the connection logs, Dorian says, creeping back over. I want to know the last access that wasn't you. Buddy, I don't think you heard me. I've got a network to reconstruct with duct tape and cardboard, and precious little time to do it. I'm trying to get the scrubbers reconnected and... Dorian places a gentle hand on Javier's shoulder. I asked you nicely. I want to know who's fucking us over. Now. Javier stops and turns to him, eyes wide in disbelief. Are you seriously questioning my priorities right now? Dorian holds the man's gaze, calmly yanking free the ballpoint pen and placing his binder on the nearby workspace. He clutches the pen in his hand, its rubberized grip flexing under his fingers, and draws up to his full height, looming over Javier. I'm not questioning your priorities. I heard them, and I gave you an order. There's enough air on this station for us to survive for weeks. There's a traitor who will kill us all a lot faster. And that's not even your biggest problem. Dorian waits for the other man to speak, but Javier says nothing. Right now, Dorian continues, you need to worry about what's going to happen the next time you tell me no. You're crazy, Javier says. Dorian takes away his hand, nostrils flaring. It feels good to be able to speak so plainly, all pretenses scrubbed away by necessity. My first girlfriend said that, he replies. But these days, she's in an institution, and I'm pulling down 7 figures. I prefer to think of it as focused. Can we get focused up, Javier? He's grown accustomed to threatening people's jobs, but that's like playing a video game. There are always extra lives. Dorian's victims will find work, or become wards of the state until some unaffordable disease kills them. But they won't starve. People are scared of him, but they rarely ever commit suicide. Worst of all are the ones near retirement, the folk who know they'll land on their feet and have run out of fucks to give. The look on Javier's face is addictive. It's better than the designer drugs passed around at executive retreats. It's better than all of the orgasms at Anne's merciless hands. It's like peeling away a hard shell to get at the quivering meat of the oyster and rake through its flesh for a pearl. Javier has no idea how to react. He's been so focused on the unseen existential threats that he's never even considered battle of wills. One little threat, and Dorian can have anything he wants. Qui audi adipositur. Who dares, wins. Tell me who the last connection is, Dorian says. Who could have gotten Silver Smile into Titus? Javier nods and begins typing in the commands to bring up the core op. A sudden concern wells within Dorian. What if he's overplayed his hand? What if Javier rallies the other survivors against him and damages his late plays in this game? The connection logs pop up, but they're full of junk. Fuck, Javier says. The virus dumped a bunch of shit into here. All that posturing for nothing. So they can't be read? Dorian asks. Your cybersecurity is shit. I didn't say that. Javier types frantically. The logs are stored on archival single-write media. The records are still there. I've just got to find the pointers. After another tense minute, he says, there. That's the beginning of this year's records. There's so much shit in the index. I'm going to have to sort it manually.
For all of his protestations, Javier is quick to comply. Maybe he wants to know the identity of the saboteur, too. Maybe he's more comfortable with someone giving orders, or maybe he's going to undermine Dorian the second he gets a chance. More of the monitors come online. Titus's bare-bones, bootstrapped image is taking effect, handling the easiest systems first. Admin rights, physical access control, basic emergency electrical. A tiling of security monitors flickers to life behind them, but Javier doesn't notice. Dorian has always wondered what he would do if given the opportunity to hurt someone. To sink his teeth into their raw pathos and look into that dark mirror to find something totally absent in himself. To be secure in the knowledge that a person can be shattered when the reflection is no longer entertaining. But to murder someone. Would that make Dorian better? Or would Javier simply cease to exist? The pain would be so brief that Dorian could scarcely call it reaffirming. Murder is so cheap. The failure to exert the will by any other means. It's intellectually lazy. Holy shit, Javier says, interrupting Dorian's train of thought. What time was the alarm? Do you remember? It had to be about 5 hours, maybe 6. What have you got? There's a shared setup ID that accessed this workstation right before the records got smeared over with junk from the virus. It's from back during the station's commissioning, when we were setting stuff up for Dr. Marsalis. Shared IDs are against company security policy. When we get back to Earth, feel free to fire me. Dorian crosses his arms, peering over Javier's shoulder. So that credential is 3 years old? Yeah, Javier says. Despite the air conditioning, his face glistens with sweat. There were only 5 of us on the Cold Forge when that ID was commissioned. Lucy helped me set everything up. That's why we worked so closely on Silver Smile. So you're saying it has to be her, man. Javier gulps once and returns to his scanning of records. There might be something else we can get from her tracks. Maybe she wasn't trying to kill everyone. What if this is just a cover to do something else? Out of the corner of Dorian's eye, a black shape moves across one of the security cameras. At first he's not sure he saw it. But the shadow moves again, and its skeletal tail uncoils. His heart slams in his chest. Dorian checks the label on the security feed. Central 104A. 4 modular spots from the skiff. It's headed in their direction. Dorian scans across the server racks for any exits. But the only ways out are through the door to the central strut, or into the processor core through a skinny maintenance access. He'd probably fit inside, though Javier never would. That might be why Javier had tiny Lucy helping him with mainframe setup. You're feeling me on this, right? Javier says. Like, Lucy isn't a bad person, you know? Dorian makes a quiet, acknowledging grunt. If it doesn't find anyone, the creature will search the room. It's too obvious that something is happening inside. Javier is clumsy and loud. He might want to share a hiding spot. Dorian quickly calculates the odds, and he doesn't like them. Then he remembers the empty server racks. Cool and quiet, like standing coffins. There's a trail of accesses here that aren't just core functions, Javier continues, leaning in to look more closely. He starts muttering about pointers, and Dorian slowly backs away. He's thankful for the loss of his shoes, and he stays on the balls of his toes so he doesn't make sucking noises with sweaty feet on the metal deck. Taking long, quiet strides, he creeps to one of the empty server racks. It's warm, but not unbearable. There's a small mesh plate on the front through which he can see and be seen. It doesn't matter. He's going inside or he's going to die.
Dorian hooks a finger into the rack's latch and pulls up as gently as he can, pressing his shoulder into the door to aid the mechanical action. If Javier sees him, he might accidentally draw the creature's attention. But the sysadmin is still nattering away about access pathways and interoperability as Dorian slips into the server rack and quietly closes the door behind him. A moment later, something passes in front of the bright work lights of the central strut, throwing a shadow across the doorway. Javier bolts upright, the change in lighting breaking through to him. Like any prey animal, he immediately looks around for his herd and discovers that he's been abandoned. The reaction is instantaneous and marvelous. His cheeks redden. His eyes swell with tears, and his hands begin to shake. He's ripening like a strawberry, sweet and juicy.
Sutler?
Not cool, man.
He pleads for it to be some kind of prank, but there's dark knowledge on his face. Through the mesh, Dorian watches Javier duck low to reach the processor maintenance access hatch. They say a rat can get into any space through which it can fit its head. Dorian leans closer to watch this miraculous contortion. Javier isn't fat. There's just a little too much of him to make a comfortable fit. He fiddles with the latches, trying to puzzle out the quietest way to open them. The creature crests the doorway, and Dorian is thankful for his height. He can stand comfortably back in shadow, almost completely obscured, while the scene plays out through the mesh frame. It's like a movie. It might make a nice painting. The devil looming on the horizon line while the sinner struggles to avoid capture. Caravaggio would have done it justice. The thing Dorian likes the most about the Cold Forge is its intense quality construction. So many parts of it result from the finest manufacturing processes. In the now bright lights of the server room, he recognizes the machined steel that was used for the processor maintenance access latch. Unlike molded or hammered steel, machined steel is precise, strong, and it makes a musical clink when it unlatches. Javier freezes in place. The beast snaps its long, gleaming skull toward the source of the sound, and it hisses like an unlit blowtorch, furious malice waiting for a spark. Dorian feels its exhilaration, watches its tightening muscles, and he wishes so desperately to record this moment so that he could watch it again and again in the darkness of his room. The beast crouches so low as to be supine, stalking the short chasms between the work tables, navigating its way toward its soft, fleshy prey. Dorian's gaze darts back to Javier, to find his lips working furiously. He's praying. His finger rests on the catch of the second latch. Maybe he's imagining the story of Daniel and the lion's den. But there is no God here. There is only the devil, the all-consuming fire of a raging star and the infinite blackness. The second clink drives a squeal from the creature, and it clamors over tables, flowing past them in a deadly ballet. It surges to a perch over Javier, tail poised to strike, lips curling, and it pauses. Javier lies shivering, curled into a ball, breath coming in heaving sobs. It's waiting for him to look. It wants him to know its glory, to see the exact moment of his transmutation from man into meat. Dorian sidles closer to the front of the locker, trying to peer around the creature for a better view of its prey. Dorian imagines himself within that armored exoskeleton, feeling its steely muscles, and lets out a quiet, hot sigh. Javier parts his fingers and weeps something in Portuguese. Then the beast snatches him up and sweeps away through the door, leaving only screams and blood in its wake.
19. Lines of communication. Blue is so happy to find a backup chair in the medbay that she forgives the